Hooray, hurrah! Once again, the Greg Proops Film Club convenes here in Hollywood's most exciting cinematic conflagration, the Los Feliz Three here, for the 1970 classic by Hal Ashby, starring Diana Sands, Beau Bridges and Pearl Bailey, The Landlord. This is where you applaud. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. Normally, I never ask you guys this kind of stuff, but have people been here before to the Greg Proops Film Club?
No.
Okay, well, that settles that. Thank you, then, for coming out tonight. This is like every other podcast you've ever seen. I'm going to talk about how vaccinations are bad for you and how you should take supplements. I'm joking, of course. I'm a straight guy, but I make no case for it whatsoever. Thank you. If I felt like comedy was any more awful than it is right now, let's just jump right in, shall we? This is a wonderful picture. It's exciting and new. And the reason is Jennifer, my wife, is the curator of all these pictures that we do here at the Greg Proops Film Club. For those of you who haven't been here before, and we only have two criterion for our movies. Is it under 2.5 hours, and is it awesome? We're never going to show, like, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai or 2001 or anything that's 1,000 hours long, because there's the spiel in the beginning, as it were. Now, this picture is a unique in a lot of ways, because one, the screenwriter is a black man named Bill Gunn, who was also an actor and a playwright. You could see him in loads of 60s television shows, and he wrote novels and a couple dozen plays at least, and a very famous cult black horror film called Ganja and Hess, from 1973, and as I said, his name's Bill Gunn, and he wrote this picture. And I don't really think there's a lot of pictures from 1970 that have black screenwriters. One, two, it's Hal Ashby's first movie, and Hal Ashby was an editor, largely, and he worked on a couple of Norman Jewison pictures, including Heat of the Night, which is a superb motion picture. Now, Norman Jewison just swirled off into the stars a couple of weeks ago at the age of 250, and he's also a very stylish and wonderful director who covered a lot of ground in his career. Not only did he do Fiddler on the Roof, and his name was Jewison, and he wasn't Jewish, which is fantastic when you think about it. He spent his entire life having Jews come up to him and saying, thank you for making Fiddler on the Roof. It's one of the great Jewish movies, and thank you for being such a great Jew. And he'd go, I'm not. My name is Jewison. But he was Canadian, so it's that tricky thing. Because Canadians will fool you with that kind of shit. Their name will be Jewison, and then they're not Jewish, and you're like, what's happening here? So he produced this picture, Norman Jewison, and he gave Hal Ashby the chance to direct this movie. Hal Ashby also directed a movie right around this time called Harold and Maude. Which is, we've showed it at the Film Club, and is one of the most superb. People always call it a cult movie, but really it's a beautiful movie about something very difficult material as far as an 18-year-old suicidal boy falls in love with a woman who'd been a survivor of the Holocaust who's intent on killing herself. And you think, well, where are the laughs? But thank you. This is a comedy show, by the way. I realize I've come right out with information. Normally, I do a bunch of shtick up front, but for some reason tonight, I've jumped in with information, which I can see is a terrible mistake. So let's go right back to the jokes here. My father took me to see, and I will put Hal Ashby up to finish this thought. A lot of people love Martin Scorsese, and I don't denigrate Martin Scorsese. He made a lot of pictures that are marvelous, and then a lot of pictures that are recent. And the one about Howard Hughes, Jesus fucking Christ. I'll never get that time back. I'll be on my deathbed going 2.5 hours. Thank you for the whole crowd. Like, I like that one. Well, that's where we differ. And I'm going to start throwing people out if I find out the kind of movies you like aren't the kind I like. You better hope I'm not the guardian in fucking heaven and you get there and go, I really like The Aviator because I'm not fucking letting you in. I will put Hal Ashby's 70s movies up against anybody's because they are Coming Home, The Landlord, Harold and Maude, The Last Detail, and Shampoo. And I think that's a fairly impressive track record. The other director from that decade, of course, that I adore is Sidney Lumet, and we've showed a lot of his pictures, particularly his 70s pictures, which include Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico, to name a million others. The thing about Hal Ashby, and Sidney Lumet for that matter, and Norman Jewison, is they were open-minded. They weren't afraid of difficult material. They were able to cover race and sex and abortion and all sorts of difficult topics. And it's the kind of thing that now you see mostly in independent movies, because Hollywood is very interested in making Avengers 27 and what's the other franchise, whatever that one is, that has people flying around with magical superpowers, and they're able to stop time and bend reality, and then at the end they have a 45-minute fist fight to settle things, because of course, when your world is full of magic, why wouldn't you just want to punch someone for half an hour? Sometimes I feel like Hollywood is run by 8-year-old boys with a semi-erection, and that's the kind of material we're getting. Why do you say that, Greg? Well, David Zaslav, I don't know if you heard, very tragic news. David Zaslav is the head of Warner Discovery and one of the heroes of the strike, let's just say that. It was revealed a couple days ago that his pay went up 26%, and he got $49 million more than he got last year. This is on top of his $100-something million stock options and whatnot. So when you wonder why television and movies aren't maybe as challenging as they could be, it might be that a lot of the money is being absorbed by people. By the way, I don't know David Zaslav. For all I know, he's in the audience here tonight because I'm sure he's a fan of independent films from the early 70s. And one thing that I'm certain that all of the studio heads in LA have in common is their love of art, commerce, and supporting artists. They wake up in the morning and they say to themselves, how can I help everyone in show business move forward a little bit today? You might want to look for the sarcasm, because that's where I've placed it right there. My father took me to see this movie in 1969, and I was, or 1970, I was 9 years old, I think. And my father had a pretty oblique sense of what was appropriate for children. Another picture we saw this year was The Wild Bunch by Sam Peckinpah. And I don't know if you've ever seen The Wild Bunch, but violence doesn't really begin to describe it. It's pretty ultra-violent. It also includes William Holden shoots a woman in the movie. And by the way, William Holden took the lead in The Wild Bunch, or Sam Peckinpah, after literally everyone in Hollywood had turned it down. Almost every actor had been offered that role, and William Holden, who was only 50 years old, took it. And I remember sitting in absolute mortal, stark terror through the entire movie. Because it's so violent, there are, of course, lyrical moments, like all Sam Peckinpah movies. What are you getting at here? So we went to see The Landlord, and it's a movie about interracial romance. It's a movie about gentrification. It's a movie about personal relationships. It's a movie about racism. It's a movie about white people and moving them off of their precepts. It's a movie about a lot of different things. And I don't think when you're nine and... you know, really, I'd just seen like Dr. Doolittle with Rex Harrison. And then the next movie is The Landlord. And you're like, this is some challenging shit. I'm glad that he took me to all these movies. On the other hand, I question his judgment sometimes. When we were watching the picture, and in this picture, there's a rent party in the movie, because Beau Bridges, our hero in the movie, buys a tenement in Brooklyn. And the tenants of the... tenement have a rent party. And a rent party is when everyone in the building gets together and they have a party in one house and they raise money to pay everyone's rent. Well, I didn't know this at nine. And when I was watching the movie, my dad goes, oh, a rent party. And my father is a Jewish man from Brooklyn, surprised. And I said, how do you know what a rent party is? And he's like, because I used to have to go collect rents. My grandfather, Everett, was a slumlord. I wish there was more humor just now, but I'm willing to go with your silence on this one. Imagine how I feel. He was also, as we say in Yiddish, a pisher, and a momser, and a gonif. So he had a lot of redeeming qualities. I believe it was my aunt Sylvia who said about my grandfather, my uncle Bill said to her, Everett had some good qualities, and she said, so did Hitler. Thank you. I love family trauma humor, but evidently we have a lot of white people here from the Midwest, and so, or Orange County, where people really refuse to believe that there's any such thing as family trauma. I was just in the Midwest as of, in fact, this morning I was in the Midwest. I was in Akron, Ohio. And let me tell you something. When you live here in California, you can get a lot of the Midwest in a real big hurry. After a day in the Midwest, you're like, all right, got it. Although I did order a horchata in Ohio, which I thought was bold and brave of me, and really leading with my chin on that one. And no, it wasn't that good. There, I've come back to tell you. White people are very huffy about their position in society, and they're often, as you may have noticed, the trials and everything, where we're trying white people for insane crimes that no one else would be allowed to even walk down the street without being clapped into irons and thrown in the biggest, dankest dungeon in the history of mankind. And yet we know that he's done all these things, and we're watching him. Well, the trial starts again tomorrow morning, aren't we? And one thing white people in the Midwest are super huffy about is that if you ever mention that they might be a little more open-minded toward race than they are, and white people in general, I find, super huffy. White people made all of the last 8 years happen. Hillary losing, Orange 45 winning, and all of the trauma that ensued from that. And so I've rescinded my white membership. I no longer want to be in the white people party. I eschew the things that white people embrace, artisanal grilled cheese sandwiches, fixed gear bikes, the Oscars, Whole Foods. I'm not hockey. Boston, the city and the group. Kansas, the state and the group. I don't want to play in white people's reindeer games as much as I might anymore. Because white people will say things like, well, what did I do? It's not my fault. And you're like, yeah, it is. But I wasn't alive before. How am I responsible for it? Because the entire race has built our superiority over everyone else on the backs of everyone else. And yet white people still get grouchy if you tell them that. Although having said that, white privilege is a pretty awesome card to carry around with you. Is there going to be more discussion of the film? I hear you cry. Certainly. When I'm done having my fucking say, it's the Greg Proops Film Club. Start your own goddamn film club. And not here tonight. Wait till I'm done. I can sense there's insurrection breaking out all over the audience here. One thing white people want to freak you out with is, for instance, this next election that's coming up here. And this is where I strike a note of hope. Because we have a black woman in the White House, we have a black woman on the Supreme Court, and no one else really ever did that before. We did it. The Democratic Party did it. We did it. Yes, including some white people. It really did happen. It's really going to happen again. Under no circumstances does Orange 45 come anywhere near the presidency again. You know that for a fact. I know you're worried and shit, and you probably look at your phone a lot and are like, oh my God, he's going to win again. He's fucking not going to win again. Let me just throw a theory at you and see if you might agree with me. Being on trial every day, day after day, in a courtroom, and complaining about it all the time and never campaigning and only having psychopaths support you doesn't increase your popularity as time wears on. In other words, I don't see people right now going, you know, I've been on the fence about him, but when I saw him complain and I heard that he was flatulent in the courtroom the other day, I said, fuck it, I'm jumping in. I need a taste of this magic. Not only is he going to lose, he's going to brutally lose, and they're going to lose the Senate and the Congress as well. And then things are going to be a lot groovier all around the ranch. I'm not saying that Democrats will solve. Thank you. I don't sell gloom and doom. I sell hope. And I don't. People who are like, oh my God, the world's so fucked up. It's never been this fucked up. Yeah, it fucking has. Only a white person would think that the world's never been this fucked up. If you weren't a white person, you would think, oh, I don't know, 40 years ago might have been pretty fucked up. or 50 years ago, or when this movie got made. In this movie is Louis Gossett Jr., who is also swirling in the stars, that wonderful actor. Diana Sands, who starred on Broadway with Louis Gossett Jr. in Raisin in the Sun, written by Lorraine Hansberry. She's in this movie. And Pearl Bailey is in this movie. Now, you guys probably don't know who Pearl Bailey is because she passed some time ago, and I don't think she's very famous or popular now. People really don't talk about her. Pearl Bailey was a musical comedy star in the 50s and 60s and 70s and the 80s. She's not in a lot of movies. She's in Porgy and Bess and a couple of others. She's in this picture. You'll catch her in this movie. Lee Grant, by the way, is in this movie too. And Lee Grant is still alive, 92 years old. And is absolutely bloody marvelous. Now, Lee Grant's story is a whole other bag. She was blacklisted for more than a dozen years and then was able to come back and make Heat of the Night and this movie and really resurrect her career in Shampoo. Notice they're all Hal Ashby, Norman Jewison joints. Pearl Bailey was a musical comedy star, like I say, and did an all-black version of Hello, Dolly! With Cab Calloway on Broadway that was an enormous smash in the late 60s. And there weren't a lot of, like, black superstars then in pictures. You might have remembered Sidney Poitier. And then a lot of people were relegated to playing. Then when black film started getting made, there was a genre called blaxploitation, which Bill Gunn's movie Ganja and Hess got lumped into. And he was quite irate about it. The New York Times wrote a review of Ganja and Hess, which is a black vampire sort of dope-smoking homosexual movie. Anyway, they diminished it. And he was like, if this was a foreign film, you would have said it was daring. But because I'm a black filmmaker and a black writer, you're smashing this movie and you want everything to be lumped into blaxploitation, which is what makes Pearl Bailey's appearance in this movie so fucking awesome. My mother was from a farm in Mississippi and was the oldest of nine children. And my mother loved Pearl Bailey. So when I was little, I grew up in San Carlos, California, the whitest place on the face of the earth, home of the Plain Yogurt Festival. And take the fruit out, the powerful taste is burning our tongues. Where One Direction was found in the hip-hop section. Now, in San Carlos, there was a cabaret there called the Circle Star Theater, and everybody played the Circle Star Theater. Richard Pryor played the Circle Star Theater. I saw Tower of Power with Cheech and Chong opening at the Circle Star Theater. But my parents were really old school, World War II parents, and they took me to see all these acts from the old days. And when I say old days, Jimmy Durante, who I don't know if anyone in this audience even knows who Jimmy, thank you. Two people know who Jimmy Durante is. Jimmy Durante had an enormous nose. He's in a lot of movies in the 40s. And his catchphrase was, cha-da-da-cha-da-da-cha-da-cha-cha-cha, right? Okay, it was old school. And he had showgirls on stage with him, showgirls with feathers and little outfits and whatnot. And a guy got up and did a catwalk that was in his act. And we also saw Ella Fitzgerald with Count Basie. And Ella Fitzgerald was fabulous and sang the theme from Sanford and Son, which was pretty wild. Sanford and Son was a TV show with Red Fox at the time. This is the early 70s. And Ella Fitzgerald was famous for her scat singing, a jazz term for improvising, right, with no words. So they played the Sanford and Son theme song, and Ella Fitzgerald went, beep, weep, beep, weep, bada bong, wada, weep, like that. It was fucking great. Then I saw her later with Jennifer, later in her career when she was older. And she was quite little and frail. She was big in the 70s, and she was littler when we saw her. And the Circle Star Theater was a theater in the round, which is the worst way to see anything in the history of mankind. There's a reason why the ancient Greeks made a proscenium and a skinny house and invented dialogue and all that, because it's better the way we're doing it now, as opposed to the Circle Star Theater, where what would happen is I would be on stage and then you'd hear an enormous crank turn on and the whole stage would start to turn like this and you'd hear, whirr. It was the most unsubtle fucking thing in the world, and the whole stage would start to turn. And so for three quarters of the show, you weren't looking at the person that you came to see. The person spun around the stage. And I'm telling you, every fucking act in the world played there. So you'd see them about a quarter of the time you were there. The other time you'd see like the back of their head, which was okay with Tower of Power because there was like 10 people on stage. So Ella Fitzgerald is put up on stage. This was a matinee in maybe 1989 or 90. And they put her in a chair, and she sang the first song, "It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got the Swing." And then she goes, "I don't feel right." And the whole crowd was World War II aged people. And a riot broke out. You've never seen this much violence at a fucking, like, Judas Priest concert. People were fucking screaming. Women, old women were yelling, "Can't you see she's not comfortable?" I thought a fucking riot was going to happen in the Circle Star Theater. The security guard ran onto the stage, and Ella Fitzgerald was so little, he picked her up and put her back down on the chair, and she went, "That's better." And then the concert went on. I've never seen such violence at a show, not a rock show, not any show, as old people unhappy that Ella Fitzgerald wasn't comfortable. So we went to see Pearl Bailey, and Pearl Bailey was fantastically at the White House a lot. And she was very funny in concert. She was a kind of a comedian and a singer and a dancer. And she goes, "I go to the White House a lot, and I'm going to be talking about it a lot tonight. So in order to kind of shorten things up, whenever I mention the White House, I'm just going to say I was at the house." So she goes on, sings a couple numbers, does a thing, and then goes, "So the other day I was at the house." And she means the White House. Nixon made her, I swear to you, the ambassador of love. Richard Nixon fucking loved her. She performed for Anwar Sadat at the Ford White House. Reagan gave her a medal. Fucking old white guys loved Pearl Bailey. And my mother loved her. And she was really, really funny. And I remember she said, she was giving some heartfelt speech. Her act was fantastically, ran the gamut from wildly sentimental to hilarious to maudlin. And she was doing a sentimental part, and a guy in the crowd went, and she went, "Oh, I love when men clear their throat, because that's how they cry in public." And then she said, "And I think I want to tell you that it was the Silvers that opened for her." I don't know if you remember the Silvers. They were a black family, and their big hit, I believe, was Boogie Fever. She said, "Like the young people say, if you let me make love to you, then why can't I touch you?" In any case, Pearl Bailey's in this picture, and I think you'll find one of the highlights of this movie is Lee Grant plays the uptight mother, and Pearl Bailey plays one of the women who lives in the apartment building in Brooklyn. And that's a scene that's really to be treasured in this movie. In some ways, I feel responsible that I haven't made you laugh more. But in another couple of ways, I feel like it's okay tonight, because it's all right sometimes to just connect and talk about these things. And also, I'm guessing that you haven't heard any of this before, since a lot of you probably haven't the slightest notion of what I've been talking about, which is fine, because you're about to see all these performers in this movie here. And Hal Ashby passed away early. Diana Sands passed away early. Bill Gunn passed away early. But Lee Grant is still here with us. And I think this movie is as resonant today, and the reason we picked it, the reason Jennifer picked it, is its cogency. We try to pick pictures here at the Greg Proops Film Club, or Jennifer does, rather. We've showed Crossing Delancey. We showed, The Band's Visit. That was to talk about Judaism. And now we're back onto race again, because I think when you're trying one of the greatest racist monsters this country's ever seen, and everybody's focused on it again, and as the media would have us say, the country's deeply divided, which I don't see at all. Having just got back from 2 weeks in the Midwest, there are white people with different opinions. Division isn't what's going on in the country. There's what's right, as my wife would say, and there's the abyss. So, and on that moral high ground, it is the hill I will die on. When a racist monster is on trial the way that we're having one now, I think it behooves us to watch some art and pick up some metaphor and try to process through the brilliance of cinema and the awesomeness of Bill Gunn's writing and Hal Ashby's direction. I give you from 1970, The Landlord.